This is Bloomberg Intelligence.
Uber wants to be the Amazon of retail, of e-commerce.
The Disney Plus service might actually end up benefiting Netflix.
In-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries.
Capital return is the key story for the U.S. banks.
The telcos naturally are moving into content distribution. I think it's a good move.
Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
Hour, we're going to dig inside the big business stories impacting Wall Street and the global markets.
Each and every week, we provide in-depth research and data on some of the 2,000 companies and 130 industries our analysts cover worldwide.
Today, we're going to take a look at the green ambitions of oil companies and if petroleum stocks can be green investments.
Plus, navigating the wild west of ESG ETFs. We look under the hood to understand the varying definitions of ESG and what these funds offer.
But first, we're going to take a look at some global utilities, and they have their sights set on net zero emissions. We want to bring in Bloomberg Intelligence senior ESG analyst Eric Kane. Okay, what are utilities doing? How is this conversation of net zero emissions that's pretty much everywhere across every industry? How's it evolving in the utility?
Sure, it's a great question, and you're exactly right. We see the conversation around net zero really taking shape in the utility sector. So we did an analysis of about 56 global utilities, and we found that 29 of them have targeted to be net zero by at least 2050. So certainly, again, in our mind, you know, we're seeing some of the most concentrated action with respect to climate targets. But at the same time, what we're seeing is that when we look at short-term goals, so the International Energy Agency's Sustainable Development Scenario, which is aligned with Paris, we're seeing only 11 of those 56 companies are actually going to meet reduction targets that are in line with maintaining warming well below 2 degrees.
So, Eric, what happens if a company does not meet its goals and the net zero emissions? Is there any ramifications, financial or regulatory?
I think it really depends on the market. What we're seeing certainly in Europe is that the European Union emissions trading system continues to kind of tighten the number of allowances that are issued. And according to Bloomberg NEF, what we're going to see over the next 10 years is more than a double in the price of a metric ton of carbon in the EU. So presumably for those companies that are less progressive in terms of reducing their emissions and maybe miss their own targets, there will be a financial cost associated with those emissions. And we're also seeing new national targets emerging in a variety of markets. So even in China and Japan, where we tend to see target setting on the part of utilities really kind of lagging behind the U.S. and Europe, we suspect that those companies are going to have to, you know, comply with their national regulations. And typically that compliance comes with associated costs.
Here's my question. If they don't hit their targets, are they going to tell us that? In that I feel like greenwashing is real. And you could definitely say, well, look over here, and if you take into account all the carbon credits that we bought, we've reduced our emissions by 75%, and then going forward, like, there's a lot of stuff like that that can be said, which may be legit, but it's not necessarily straight up reduction from their production or reduction from their actual business. Is that something that winds up happening a lot?
It does happen a lot, and certainly that's a major concern in a lot of industries, where, as you suggested, when we look at the details of these carbon reduction targets, we're seeing a lot of reliance on offsets, or we're seeing a lot of reliance on technology that may not even be available yet. I do think for utilities it's a little bit different. I think the analysis is really quite clean and much more transparent, and by that, I mean, when we look at utilities, the idea of being completely carbon neutral in terms of power generation doesn't rely on technology that isn't already available. So we do have examples of companies that are essentially net zero. They've done this by retiring their fossil fuel power plants and replacing it with things like wind or solar. So in my mind, it's a lot harder for utilities to greenwash, because if a company is running a coal-fired power plant, you can essentially measure the emissions from that. You know how much power each is generating, and you can come up with a reasonable estimate in terms of their carbon intensity, just based on where their power is coming from. It's a lot more difficult for them to hide behind the numbers.
So, Eric, for the companies that are not compliant or are unlikely to become compliant, is it a function of they're just not spending the money? Is it a function of they just have a philosophical opposition to this neutral footprint? What are some of the reasons we're seeing out there in the marketplace?
Yeah, so I think it's really evolved over time. I think for a long time there was kind of a philosophical objection to transitioning to, you know, low carbon or even net zero. I think a lot of that opposition was, of course, based in the economics of energy production. So for a long time, coal was, you know, one of the cheaper ways to produce power. What we're seeing is, of course, those equations are changing significantly. So coal is no longer, you know, necessarily the cheapest way to provide energy, and companies are starting to realize that. So, of course, they're switching to cleaner forms of energy because they're more economic, and they also see the writing on the wall in terms of regulation and future potential costs. Mm-hmm. So I think those that aren't taking those steps, it is a little bit hard to understand why they're not. I think in some cases it may be, you know, limited access to the types of renewable generating that we tend to see. You know, if a company has their assets located in an area, for example, where, you know, wind generation isn't a possibility, you know, they may have a tougher time, of course, developing that capacity and subsequently reducing their emissions.
Eric, thanks a lot. Really fun conversation. Eric Kane, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior ESG Analyst.
Coming up on the program, we look at BlackRock's new Carbon Transition Readiness ETF and how it stacks up against similar funds.
You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the Terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 13 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
Okay, so you've made the commitment to be a good ESG investor, and you're taking a look at some ETFs that might give you some exposure, but you're just not sure what the ETF owns. Let's take a look and see how we can get a clearer picture there. We welcome Shaheen Contractor. She is an ESG analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence. All right, Shaheen, ETFs, ESGs, where do I start?
Thanks, Paul. It's a great question. And you know, when someone says, here's an ESG ETF, the problem is very often no one has any idea what that means. There are so many definitions of ESG, and fund strategies are often opaque. So that's really why we took a step back and we created this ESG ETF scorecard, which really helps investors measure and compare the ESG characteristics across funds. So what we did is we took a couple of ESG metrics for the fund's holdings, rolled it up to the fund level, and compared funds across it. So just a really comparable way of answering the question, how much ESG are you offering when you call yourself an ESG ETF?
What is it? Like, walk us through the scoring of that, because I'm also, the reason why I was hesitating was because I'm also interested in the derivative plays. So it feels like an oil company wouldn't score high, but if the oil company is divesting oil assets and buying wind farms, they may eventually score high. So what's in the granular data?
Of course. So we're really looking at three pillars, so across the E, the S, and the G. And within E, we're selecting, say, a couple of metrics. And the metrics that we're really selecting is metrics that are disclosed well across companies. So within the E pillar, it's really looking at things like the carbon intensity of a fund. We're also looking at CDP's climate change performance score. And then we're also looking at our own Bloomberg's environmental disclosure score. So it's really balancing performance and disclosures. And the reason we do this is because if we don't, we have too many holes. Mm-hmm. For other data sets, we have coverages of around 20% of our universe, and that's just not enough. So these are really the metrics that, you know, get us to 80%, which is the only way we can not skew ourselves when we're trying to compare funds.
How many ESG ETFs are there out there in the marketplace? It seems like, you know, we're hearing more and more about ESG investing. And of course, ETFs are exploding.
Of course. If I were to paint a ballpark number, I would say right now they're close to 500.
Wow.
I think
what's
important and I think very interesting is the asset growth. So assets have doubled just in 2020, although I would say that assets are very concentrated. It's probably one fund that is doubling and tripling. So you do need a wider investor base to sustain this growth if you want to continue this, you know, doubling and tripling.
How many of these ETFs are de facto tech ETFs?
Well, if you consider an overweighting to tech to be sort of de facto tech, I think just by the general nature of ESG and, you know, being energy light, they tend to overweight tech.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think this de facto overweighting tech, it does ignore the social and the governance concerns that these tech companies have. I almost feel like tech companies get a free pass into ESG ETFs just because they have a low mm-hmm. environmental footprint.
Greenwashing.
That's a fair point.
Yep.
Greenwashing. What is it, and do I need to be worried about it?
Greenwashing is, well, by definition, sort of a fund's claim to do something, but it is in fact not. So it's termed as misleading an investor. I think as ESG funds grow and asset managers launch all these funds to capitalize off growth, greenwashing concerns are coming under increasing investor and regulatory scrutiny. I think just last month we had a Japanese regulator look into a fund by Morgan Stanley on potential greenwashing concerns. I would say that a lot of the greenwashing, I think, stems from, again, going back to the fact that when I say, here's an ESG fund, no one has any idea what that means, just because there's so many ways we can define it.
Do you think that we're going to see something from the administration at some point that says, that lays out more specific criteria to make it a little easier for investors to judge this stuff?
I would say I hope so. Europe is going down that road. They have the EU benchmark regulations where index providers have to spell out certain ESG metrics like the carbon intensity, similar things that are in our scorecard. Only for Europe as of now. Hope it expands across the world, but it is a good starting point and very much needed to facilitate this comparison.
So in terms of, you know, the quality of these ESG funds, in terms of their ESG makeup and their bona fides, is Europe again leading the way here?
Of course it is, Paul.
Yep.
yes. So, you know, European companies are well ahead in terms of ESG disclosures, ESG performance. And that, of course, reflects in the fund, which is obviously a makeup of these companies. What I would add to that is that if you compare a fund to a benchmark, Europe also has the greatest additionality, which just means that, you know, compared to the stock 600, how much ESG are you getting? Europe just does that more than that compared to the US and the S&P 500, compared to EM, ESG, and just emerging markets.
So using your scorecard, what did you notice? Like, which funds did really well? Which funds were really bad?
Sure. So if you consider the US, you have some funds like the iShares, the DWS, all the funds that follow the MSCI USA Leader suite of indexes that lead. You have the iShares ESG Aware ETF that is a comparative laggard. And I think another important point to add is just the amount of fees you're paying for these funds. I mean, if you look at the ESG Aware fund that lags, it's about 15 basis points. But if you look at the leader, it's about 10 basis points. So you're paying for more for less ESG.
Hmm.
When I think about ETFs, I think retail. So is that the case, like the retail investor, the individual investor, as opposed to the institutional client? Give us a sense of kind of what you're seeing in the ESG pillar of the ETF space.
You know, that's a great question, Paul, and that's completely right. Although when you say that ETFs are sort of retail in nature, but I think ESG is a way to attract these institutions into ETFs. If you look at, say, BlackRock's recent carbon transition ETF, it got flows from CalPERS, from large institutional investors. And that's where we see most of the ETFs getting their seed money. It's still the world of institutions that's investing in ESG.
Our thanks to Bloomberg Intelligence ESG analyst Shaheen Contractor. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Coming up on the program, we take a look at the world of green bond mutual funds and what investors are willing to pay for an ESG designation.
You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence via BI Go on the terminal. I'm Paul Sweeney.
And I'm Alex Steele. It's 25 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
We'll be here each and every week at this time, tapping into our Bloomberg Intelligence analysts, covering some 2,000 companies and 130 industries worldwide.
All right, let's tackle the next leg of this green investing and take a look at green bonds and sort of what are they and how they perform versus regular old boring bond markets. For more, we're going to welcome Bloomberg Intelligence ESG analyst Simone Andrews. So, Simone, when I think of a green bond, I think of a couple things. One, a company that does green stuff that's raising money. Two, a company that's raising money to go do green things, even if the company isn't quote-unquote green. Or three, a bond that's tied to green ambitions and climate goals. Where am I wrong? Where am I right?
No, you definitely hit it on the head. I mean, when I'm talking about green bonds, I'm talking about bonds where the use of proceeds, so the funding, is going towards a green project. We're also starting to see other types of bonds called sustainability-linked bonds, where it's really about the corporate entity and their ESG or sustainability goals. So you have kind of both at the same time happening in the market.
All right, Simone, I need a definition here. What is the Bloomberg Intelligence Greenium Python model, and how do you use it?
First of all, best name. Just throw Python in there. Like, okay, sold. And then...
Yes. So it really just came from, when you're looking at the green premium, so basically what that means is when a green bond yields are lower than the conventional bonds, there basically appears to be a green premium. It was just challenging to do this through our typical search functions, FIW, and it's not because it's impossible. It's just there's tons of debt issuance out there. So what the model does for clients is that it basically makes that search looking for comparables easier. And so what we've sought out to do is to say, okay, we've got this surge of green bonds, but there's still this huge imbalance between supply and demand in the market, meaning that there's a lot of investors who are looking to buy green, but there's just not enough supply. And that has led to this kind of talk about there could be a green premium. So what we found is that we are starting to see some green premium in the market, mostly in Europe. You are starting to see it in the U.S., but it's not as pronounced.
Who's buying?
It's mostly institutional investors who's buying green bonds. You're also just starting to see, because there's a lot of governments out of the pandemic who are responding, their policy response is to let's create jobs, but let's make it so that we're also, making environmentally friendly investments at the same time. So you saw a lot of countries like Germany, the UK most recently are issuing green bonds, and that in turn, I believe, has spurred more liquidity in the market and more demand in the market.
All right, Simone, if I'm an issuer, what's the incentive for me to go for a green designation, whether it's on a security or my company? What's in it for me?
It's a really good question. I think before we started talking about green premiums, it was really the thought process was this is going to cost, from an issuer's perspective, this is going to cost me more. I've got to pay up for the third-party designation. I've got to also keep track. So the benefits now, if you're talking about a green premium, is that if you're an issuer who's coming to the market, now you can say, hey, look, when I issue my bond, it's a little bit cheaper for me to come to the market with this green bond versus if I had just done a conventional plain vanilla bond. So there's pricing advantages starting to appear. Marketing your market, you're able to really tap into new investors who are looking to be more sustainable. And I just think green bonds are just an easy way to create impact from an investor perspective.
How have they performed?
Yeah, and that's what the model has been able to prove, is that if we look at green bonds that were issued this quarter, we're starting to see a modest premium for green bonds.
Simone, talk to us about the issuance activity out there. Is it still growing? What are the sectors or what are the types of companies that are really trying to participate in this market?
It's just such a fascinating time to cover this market. I mean, it's been growing exponentially since 2007. Last year was a record year in sales. And then this quarter was a record year. It reached $150 billion, which was the highest quarterly sales in the last 10 years. It's just, it's a hot market, and issuers are getting out there and issuing, and you're starting to see it from not only the typical, the usual suspects, which were utilities and financials. You're also starting to see other sectors, other types of currencies come into the market, and that's what's so exciting, the diversification space.
Simone, really great work. Really appreciate it. Simone Andrews, Bloomberg Intelligence ESG analyst. Paul, you got like two good questions in there. That's,
I know.
That's not fair.
ESG stuff is cool. There's a lot going on.
Oh, my God. What, a year ago, I couldn't get you interested.
I know. But now the money's coming in. That got my interest. All right. Coming up on the program, oil companies are outperforming our carbon neutral theme basket this year. Plus, the investment case for oil charge exploration and production.
Look at how excited he is. All right, you're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 39 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
Let's continue the conversation of green investing and take a look at it from an oil angle. I mean, if you're big oil, you're dirty, right? There's no way you can be looked at as a green investment. Well, maybe not. Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Energy and Transportation Analyst Rob Barnett joins us now. Rob, in what way can an oil company become green?
Well, now, first of all, I think if you had Greta Thunberg, you'd get a very different answer. But what I would say is that many of the oil companies that we monitor as part of our coverage at Bloomberg Intelligence have made the commitment to become carbon neutral. In fact, we've got 21 oil and gas companies in our carbon neutral theme basket that have said by 2050 they're going to reduce their Scope 1, Scope 2 emissions to net zero. Now, these are large and serious companies. You've got BP, Shell, Total, Equinor, Eni, basically the European oil majors. I would note that U.S. companies like Exxon and Chevron are notably absent, at least so far, but you do have companies like ConocoPhillips and Occidental included. Now, what are they going to do? I mean, there's a whole myriad of things, but I think in the short term, you've got efficiency, reduced flaring, reduced methane, renewables, EV charging. Longer term, it's probably things like more gas, more renewables. And in the very long term, it's less oil, certainly more renewables, and even speculative things like carbon capture and storage or hydrogen.
So for those of us who don't spend our days on oil fields or oil rigs out in the middle of the North Atlantic, explain to us how oil companies discharge emissions. I mean, it just seems like their whole existence is just putting stuff into the air and stuff into the water and stuff into the – that's just the nature of digging for oil and all that kind of stuff.
Well, I think you're absolutely right that the byproduct of the industry is emissions, but at the same time, the industry is giving us something we very much want in the form of energy. And so what you're going to see through time is that these companies are going to become more of energy names and less of oil and gas names. Okay. It's very interesting if you take a look at an offshore wind turbine being installed. There's lots of technological and skill overlap with the offshore oil and gas industry, and you're actually seeing players like BP and Equinor that have a lot of expertise in the offshore E&P industry also now making strides in the offshore wind industry.
And then you have other companies that are just kind of like, we're just going to add this as a tack on to our business and like get into wind because we're going to make money later down the road. My question, though, when do you think these oil companies get credit for doing that? Because in the meantime, right, they're still producing their oil, which they're making nice, juicy money right now, oil where it is. On the flip side, they have to put out a lot of money to ramp up the other assets. So when do you think that turns?
I think it's a very long duration kind of question. So we're giving them credit for the fact that they've made the commitment to go carbon neutral, but this is a multi-decade process, in our opinion. And right now, when you look at the oil patch for the ones that have committed to become carbon neutral, they're investing something like 10-15% of CapEx on energy transition type projects. That could be renewables, it could be EV charging, many different things, but we're seeing it slowly tip in that direction. None of these companies overnight is making a sort of sudden stop and just exiting the oil business altogether. This is a multi-generational problem, climate change, and the solutions have to be multi-generational. So we're going to watch slowly as some of these companies transform. And I would say, you know, it really could be a Kodak-type moment. You know, you want to be on the company that is on the right side of history on this stuff. And, mm-hmm. and the world is certainly looking quite different in the future than it has in the past, at least when we read the tea leaves.
All right. So, Rob, you mentioned ExxonMobil and Chevron are they're certainly behind their European peers. Is that just a function? We don't have the political will in this country to move more towards a green economy?
I think politics are certainly a factor here, but it's not the only thing you have to pay attention to. I do think that the U.S. has been more reticent in general to move in this direction, but President Biden is speaking very strongly on the issue of climate change. He's announced recently a partnership with China. I mean, the UK is saying they're going to be net zero by 2050 with a 78% reduction in emissions by 2035. I mean, how do you achieve these goals? You can't do it if you keep doing energy the old way. And it simply necessitates a change in the way we produce and consume our energy. And fortunately, for a lot of these companies, a lot of solutions already exist, and it's just about moving in at the right pace and time. A lot of oil companies got burned by moving too early on the issue of renewables, climate change, alternative energy. But now the time seems ripe, and we're slowly seeing companies move in. But there's a portfolio. There's no right answer. We still don't know whether something like carbon capture and storage is going to play out or mm-hmm. hydrogen is going to play out.
All right, Rob, great to catch up with you. Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Energy and Transportation Analyst Rob Barnett.
All right, let's stick with the energy discussion, but let's talk about earnings because it is that time of the quarter to do that. We welcome Vince Piazza, Senior Energy Analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence. All right, Vince, give us a sense of how things are going for the big oil companies these days.
Yeah, so on the upstream side, Paul, I think things are looking up for the E&Ps going into 1Q earnings season. So I think that the theme for earnings season for the upstream space, restrained production and CapEx, driving free cash flow higher, setting the tone for 2021, and setting up a conversation with the investor base about how we repatriate capital, excess cash, to the investors given this period of capital discipline. And that is very different than what we saw last year, and given the COVID-related weakness when we thought these guys were on their last legs.
Okay, at what point does the oil prices get too tempting and that they start ramping up and spending more on CapEx?
Well, I think you're seeing it right now. What I think you're seeing here is getting back to a normal level, right? You started to see frac spreads heading higher, additional rigs coming back online in that $50-$55 a barrel range. I think 60 is where you start to get a little bit concerned about new capital coming into the space for new output as opposed to completing that backlog of drilled but uncompleted wells. So I think right now in the mid to high 50s, you're in that sweet spot where you're throwing off free cash flow and looking at your payout, your dividend payout, to repatriate those funds to the investor base who do not want to see the production growth, but do want to see dividend growth. They do want to see that capital coming back to them, and they do want to see the balance sheets get repaired in this industry.
So that's kind of where I wanted to go, Vince. Give us a sense of where we are with the capital structure of this industry, because it's a classic boom and bust kind of industry. Where are we right now?
So I think right now you still have a period of, in 2021 and 2022, a debt wall that we need to get past. And there is a free cash flow coming online in 2021 and 2022 to deal with that. So the companies are in much better shape today than they were last year or during the last bottom of the cycle. The capital markets are indeed open. The debt window is indeed open. You're starting to see deals come on through the pipeline. So from a capital structure, from repairing the balance sheet, these guys are well on their way. $50, $60 oil does provide some incremental confidence to repay that debt, refinance that debt. I'm not concerned about that. What I am concerned, Paul, is do these companies get back to that mode where production growth takes precedence? And I don't think that's going to be the case as we head into the 2021. As we think about free cash flow, companies in the Permian will throw off significant levels of free cash flow. And that'll come back to the investor base in the form of not only base dividends, but also variable dividends. And we should look to Pioneer Natural when they report. They are a big proponent of this base dividend and also variable payout component as a way to reflect the success of the business and the volatility and the variability of the business throughout 21 and throughout 2022. But that's also the case for the natural gas players, especially Appalachia. We should see free cash flow, significant free cash flow in Q1 for the Appalachian names, for the Marcellus names. The same theme here on natural gas as on the oil side, restrained CapEx, restrained production with the hope of repatriating the excess capital, repatriating the excess cash to the investor base.
All right, Vince, always good to catch up with you. Vincent Piazza, Bloomberg Intelligence, Senior U.S. Oil and Gas Analyst.
That's this week's edition of Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries.
All right, remember, you can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 57 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.